From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's a scenario to keep you up at night. Al-Qaeda buys a nuclear warhead. The device is smuggled into the United States, maybe on a container ship. And at the moment of Osama bin Laden's choosing, New York, Los Angeles, or Chicago is vaporized in a catastrophic nuclear explosion. Unthinkable. American security experts say this scenario, or one like it, is all but inevitable, maybe even imminent. Tonight on Point, the very real threat of nuclear terrorism and how it can be stopped. But first, we begin tonight in London, where today eight men accused of plotting terrorist attacks in Britain and the United States appeared in court for the first time. Security was tight at Belmarsh Magistrates Court, where the men were remanded without bail until their preliminary hearing on August 25th. Tanya Brannigan is a reporter for London's Guardian newspaper and was at the court today. I asked her to describe the security precautions as the suspects were brought to court.
Well, as you would expect, it was pretty high security. Belmarsh Magistrates Court is actually a very high security magistrates court anyway, and that's where most terror-related cases are heard in London. On this occasion, the defendants were brought in two separate convoys. The first arrived about 9 o'clock. The second arrived a couple of hours later. There were police cars, police vans, and also helicopters sort of keeping an eye on them along the route. Once they actually got into court, each person was escorted by two officers in body armour. Again, that's actually quite typical for sort of a terror case of this kind.
Remind us of the charges against these eight men.
They're charged with conspiracy to murder. It doesn't say who they were planning to murder. Possibly the authorities don't know. We just can't tell at this stage. They're accused of conspiring with unknown people at some point between 2000 and their arrest on August the 3rd. On top of that, they're also accused with conspiracy to commit a public nuisance, which might not sound very startling, but in this case, they're supposed to have conspired to plot a chemical, gas-related, or possibly radioactive or explosive attack.
So radioactive is right there in the heart of this complaint. Is it clear what kind of evidence the government has at all yet?
No. I mean, it's obviously at a very, very early stage. These people have been held for 2 weeks. They've been obviously charged, but it is really a very early stage. We're certainly not going to get a trial before 2005, and I would suspect well into the year. So I would imagine that the police probably have quite a long way to go here. And it's important to state that it does say in the charge that it's possibly a radioactive attack, possibly another form of attack. So, I mean, it's certainly not clear what the precise nature of the allegations is at this stage.
The image of eight alleged terrorists coming into court on one day is a striking one. How did such a large number come to be arrested at the same time?
Well, there was a whole series of raids. There were several raids sort of executed on the same day. In fact, 13 people were arrested. Four of those have since been freed or have been questioned about completely unrelated alleged terrorist offences. A ninth man has been charged with possessing a firearm, but he's been dealt with separately, and there's no indication that that's very serious. The other guys, as I said, were picked up in a series of raids around Britain, mainly around London and the southeast, but also a couple sort of up in the north.
Two of the men of these eight were charged with possessing reconnaissance that Americans heard a lot about not long ago. Is that right?
That is correct. It's all pretty hazy at this point because we don't know when they're supposed to have possessed them. The charge sheet says that they possessed them at some point between 2000 and 2004. There's certainly nothing very precise there. One of the guys is supposed to have possessed documents relating to the Prudential in New Jersey. The other two have possessed documents relating to the Stock Exchange in New York and the IMF in Washington as well. But as I said, it's really not sort of clear when all that took place or what it referred to.
So the beginning of a trial that won't come to fruition for some time there, but an impressive number of alleged terrorists in the dock and off the proceedings go today. Tanya Brannigan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tanya Brannigan is a reporter for The Guardian. She spoke with me from London. Nuclear terrorism. It's a favorite plot for fiction and film. Tom Clancy wrote about an A-bomb at the Super Bowl in The Sum of All Fears. James Bond tried to stop the bomb in The World Is Not Enough. But the threat of terrorists detonating a nuclear device on American soil is very real. On September 8, 2002, Condoleezza Rice sounded a strong warning. "We don't want the smoking gun," she said, "to be a mushroom cloud." She was talking about Iraq then, but a nuclear attack inside America is a very real concern for top-level security experts now, including our guest tonight. "The fissile material is out there," he says. "So is the money, the expertise, and the will to deliver a bomb. It's not a matter of if," says one anti-terror expert. "It's a matter of when." The Bush administration has been talking about the nuclear threat for years. Our guest tonight believes not enough has been done to prevent the unthinkable. Tonight on Point, the very real threat of nuclear terror on American soil and what can be done to stop it. Are you prepared to acknowledge the reality of the threat of a nuclear attack by terrorists? If Al-Qaeda was able to pull off the September 11th attacks, what is stopping it from a nuclear strike? What can, what should the United States be doing right now to head off a nuclear attack on American soil? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Graham Allison, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Studies at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was assistant secretary for defense policy and plans during the first Clinton administration, and he is author of the new book, Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. Graham Allison, wonderful to have you with us again.
Pleasure to be here.
Scary book, Graham. You're really getting our attention. We hear these words, inevitable, all but inevitable, even imminent. What's the right way to describe the threat of nuclear terrorism inside the United States as we sit here tonight?
I myself believe it's a very real threat, and I think everyone who's examined the issue in fine detail agrees that this is an imminent threat. In part one of my book, I try to take you through the who could do it, where could they get the weapon, what kind of weapon, how could they get it into the U.S.? And by the end of the part one, one comes to virtually inevitable. And I've been a little bit controversial with the proposition, but it's a bet that I continue offering and making. I'll bet 51 of my dollars against 49 of somebody else's dollars, and I've got a number of such bets out, that unless we make a radical departure from current behavior, the U.S. government and other governments, within a decade, unfortunately, we'll see such an event. So I think it's more likely than not, absent sharp departure from current behavior.
I'm not sure that wagering over nuclear attack on the U.S. is a wager I would even want to get into. I don't have your nerve on that, maybe. It is clear in your reporting here how seriously this has been taken at the very highest levels of the U.S. government. I wish you'd convey to us in some detail the story you outlined at the very beginning of your book about the Dragonfire incident, which unfolded only a month after September 11th, 2001, and at least to me, went a long way toward explaining the kind of ongoing paranoia, fear, alertness, whatever you want to describe it, that we saw around the White House at that time. What happened with this Dragonfire case, Graham, that will illustrate or illuminate the fear of nuclear terror for us?
Well, it's a real incident, not a hypothetical. 1 month after the assault on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, Director of CIA George Tenet went into the president and said, a CIA agent codenamed Dragonfire reports that Al-Qaeda has a 10-kiloton mini-nuke, a very small nuclear weapon that would produce an explosion about the size of Hiroshima, in New York City, that they got out of the former Soviet arsenal.
And he's saying in October 2001, Mr. President, our report is that it's there now. It's in New York.
That's the report. So stunned silence, the questions begin to be raised. Did the Soviet Union have 10-kiloton weapons? Yes. Could there be some 10-kiloton weapons from the former Soviet arsenal missing? Yes. Could Al-Qaeda have such a weapon? Yes. Could Al-Qaeda have such a weapon in New York City without our otherwise knowing about it? Yes. So there was no basis on which to dismiss this report.
When you say a 10 kiloton, a small bomb, but yet you say the size of Hiroshima, you mean it's physically small. But
physically small in the sense of...
What it's size?
It's the size of a... it would fit in the back of a van, like the van that the terrorist Yosef parked in the basement of the World Trade Center in 1993.
Okay,
so the kind of vans you see driving around... that you see around the streets.
Could be in the back of a van. And President Bush, fall of 2001, has in the Oval Office on his desk the notion that it is there now in New York City. It could be detonated any time. What does he do?
Well, he first takes a deep breath. Vice President Cheney evacuates the White House and moves to this undisclosed site, which is subsequently been disclosed, but the so-called R site in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Which was hard to understand at the time, but this incident makes a lot clearer what that might be, because they thought, well, if there's one in New York, there could also be one in Washington. We can't have a decapitation move on the U.S. government, so Cheney goes off to a safe location.
Okay. And then all sources go out to try to determine whether this report is correct. It turns out after 3 days that it's not confirmed. There's no confirming evidence, but NEST teams, these nuclear emergency safety teams, went to New York City. They decided not to tell Mayor Giuliani. That's interesting. And after the fact, when he learned about it, he was not too happy.
Why did they decide not to tell Giuliani?
Well, they were afraid that if this became to be known, if it leaked out,
there's a new in New York. It could go off. New Yorkers would flee the city.
Absolutely.
Presumably.
And people might even flee other cities, not knowing whether there were a weapon in some one of the other cities. So they began to investigate the report. In the end, it turned out to be a false report. But it brought people face to face with the possibility that this could actually happen. And President Bush began describing thereafter what he called his ultimate nightmare. A nuclear terrorist attack. The world's most destructive technologies, as he says, in the hands of the world's most dangerous actors.
We'll talk about your dissatisfaction with what you see as a gap between that kind of talk and what's actually been done. But first, you know, it's been a long time since World War II. Lots of Americans born since then, little idea of what this would mean. If there were a bomb in the middle of a major city, let's say in New York, 10 kiloton, as was feared in October of 2001, if it went off, what's the impact, Graham Allison?
Well, you're right that most people think this was about the Cold War and the Cold War is over, and so this must be history. But these are physical objects that haven't gone away. And if you take a 10 kiloton weapon, I, in the book, offer the scenario of the weapon in a van in Times Square on a normal workday, about 500,000 people could be killed promptly. That is, out to a third of a mile from ground zero, things are vaporized and essentially disappear. Mm. Out to about a mile, buildings look like the Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City.
So if you gutted skeletons.
Gutted skeletons.
A mile, that gets you up toward the U.N.
That gets you very close to the U.N. That mm-hmm. gets you down to...
A huge chunk of Manhattan.
A huge chunk of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. And beyond that?
And then beyond that, you've got fires and fallout. And so in time, you could imagine that even a million people could die from such an incident.
And a city that would be uninhabitable for some time?
Well, it certainly would not be a place where people would want to live for some considerable period of time, absolutely, because you'd have a high level of radiation. But the main thing would just be you would have a level of devastation that we simply can't imagine. Now, in the book, I actually described this for a couple of other cities, and we've put up... so that people can visualize this a little bit more carefully, in conjunction with a book, a website called nuclearterrorism.org, where you can go and put in your city and put in the size of weapon that you would imagine they would have, something like Al-Qaeda's 10-kiloton weapon, and look to see what does Boston look like, what does... I was in Colorado recently, and some kid who was driving one of the senators to the meeting said, what are you guys talking about? And the senator told him, nuclear terrorism. And the kid said, what is that about? And he was describing it to him. The kid said, well, you mean if a nuclear bomb went off, what would happen to Aspen, Colorado? And the senator said, there would be no Aspen. He said, you mean the building where my books are? You know,
just for starters. We're talking about concentric circles of destruction in American cities. We're talking about the very real threat of nuclear terror on American soil. My guest tonight is Graham Allison, author of the new book, Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. You can join our conversation tonight. Are you prepared psychologically to acknowledge the reality of the threat of nuclear attack by terrorists on America. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the very real threat of nuclear terror on American soil, of city centers from New York to L.A. vanishing in the blink of an eye. My guest tonight is Graham Allison. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy and Plans in the first Clinton administration. He's author of the new book, Nuclear Terrorism. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you taking on board this widespread view of security experts that without drastic action, such an attack is now all but inevitable? And if nuclear attack is the number one terror threat, why hasn't the United States done more to prevent it? Have you seen the pictures of Hiroshima, of Nagasaki? Can you imagine that landscape of hell in New York, in L.A., in your city? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Graham Allison, the notion that this is all but inevitable, even potentially imminent, sort of strains, I think, some people's, maybe even my own, sense of al-Qaeda. Think of nuclear weapons, you think of big facilities and lots of technical expertise and very difficult to obtain materials. Make your case. Paint the picture for us of where this threat lies, of what makes it so real, of what makes it so potentially even imminent.
Well, a very good question, and it's a complicated answer, but I think you start with the, and I try in part one to start with the who. Who could do this? There used to be a debate about whether anybody wanted to kill thousands of people at one time. After 9/11, that should be finished. Al-Qaeda has said, in Bin Laden's press spokesman, Abu Ghaith, has announced an objective to kill 4 million Americans. And he has a grotesque, but I thought, rather interesting logic for picking this number. It doesn't come out of whole cloth. This is the number of Muslims whom he says have been killed by Israel and the U.S. And he goes through incidents, and he gets this 4 million.
And he says, we have the right to kill 4 million Americans, 2 million of them children, and to exile twice as many and wound and cripple hundreds of thousands, claiming the right to do it.
Right. And so if you say, how many 9/11 attacks would it take to kill 4 million? The answer is about 1,400.
I mean, if you did it with jet airliners.
They were trying to do it just doing repeats of 9/11. Bin Laden has indeed recently challenged the whole al-Qaeda movement to trump 9/11. Now, make the list of things that can trump 9/11.
Okay, so it's fairly short. So motivation and who, I think most Americans would know where to look and be ready to believe, but the capacity.
Well, that's the harder part to get one's mind around. Nuclear weapons were made by governments over the period of the Cold War, but then the Soviet Union disappeared. And when the Soviet Union disappeared, one was left with a kind of a chaotic situation in which there were about 20,000 nuclear weapons, including large numbers of small nuclear weapons, and one was left with material for making another 70,000 nuclear weapons. So potentially some of those weapons or some of that material have come loose, and indeed every day I worry about material that's not loose today but that might come loose.
You say potentially some of it has come loose. That's kind of vague. Do we know that there's loose nuclear material out there or not? What's known?
Well, we know that some material that from which you could make nuclear weapons has been stolen out of Russia and transported to places where we found it and we captured the people involved, or the Russian government captured the people involved, or in one case, the German government captured the people involved, or the Czech government captured the people involved. So there's a number of incidents, and I describe them in the book, in which actual material of the sort that you would use for making a nuclear weapon had been stolen by somebody who was prepared to sell it to somebody, but that transaction was interrupted.
And we know that al-Qaeda has gone shopping for these materials
very
deliberately.
They've been shopping, and if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, they give a very vivid description of how since 1993 al-Qaeda has been shopping for this. What we don't know is that anybody's made a successful transaction or a successful buy. We also know that there were a large number of small, very small, backpack and suitcase size nuclear weapons that were made during the Cold War, and that there's good reason to believe that not all of those, in the case of the former Soviet Union, were accounted for. The fellow who was the national security advisor to Yeltsin on one occasion allowed that 84 of them they were unable to account for. Now, then there were lots of stories back this way and that way, and in the book I try to trace that story as far as I can. What you can tell from what the Russian government has said is that what it's saying is not true, because they've said simultaneously that no such weapons existed, that all such weapons have been destroyed, that none were lost.
Right. I mean, so something's kind of funky there. So there's motivation and there's material, but what about the expertise to deliver it, to prime it, to set it off, all of that? It sounds like ranks of scientists in lab coats.
Unfortunately not. You have two versions of this. One would be if a suitcase nuclear bomb were stolen or had been stolen and now was available to al-Qaeda, brought to the U.S., triggering such a device is, you know, only requires, in effect, pressing a button. So that's not, that's a fixed nuclear weapon itself. Okay. Or if the weapon came out of Pakistan.
Yeah.
Or if even if it came out of North Korea, potentially.
Pakistan, which has been exporting nuclear technology,
yes,
AQ-Khan and all that.
AQ-Khan. So in any case, there's the weapon. The thing that most people don't appreciate is that if al-Qaeda or some other terrorist group gets itself 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium, which is less than the size of a football, it can, using the design that the Americans used in Hiroshima, which is not a new technology but is 60 years old and which has been available on the Internet now for more than 30 years, which is a design that was so robust that it was never tested. Hiroshima was the test of that design, and the scientists...
It's so straightforward, so simple, in other words,
right.
When you
say robust. The scientists involved were so confident that they didn't even...
Just drop it, it'll work.
Imagine, yeah, and imagine dropping something and it didn't go off. Okay, so they were concerned. So I think in this case, you've got a potential for a group even like al-Qaeda to, if it got 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium, to bring it into a place like the U.S., well, how could they get it here? When I do that in the chapter, how could they get it here, the answer is you could follow the golf clubs. So just the same way people might send their golf clubs from Tokyo or Jakarta to come here through the container ship, fewer than 5% of the containers are opened. Even if the container is open, if the material is shielded, it's very hard to detect. Or they could actually go across one of the borders where there's no place where no things are being checked. I mean, people
In the Dragonfire incident, the kind of black humor going on then was, well, they could send it in a bale of marijuana. That comes in all the time.
Absolutely. So the number of ways for getting it here. Now, by the end of part one, I think, and most people who spend much time studying this say, well, gee, the only puzzle is why has this not happened already? And that's a huge puzzle. I think it is a huge puzzle. Why has this not happened already? If it happened tomorrow, God forbid, and I'm praying no such thing should happen, but if it happened tomorrow, the expert community would have a much easier time explaining how it happened.
Than why it hasn't.
Right.
That's a scary thought. You know, I've stood at that Ground Zero in Hiroshima. Many people have visited there. It's just a profoundly... depressing, sobering, overwhelming image of the destruction that goes on and on. To imagine that in the middle of American City, it does challenge us psychologically to take it on board. I think we're talking about the threat of nuclear terror on American soil. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Ivan is calling from New York. Hi, Ivan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question having to do with a more strategic issue, and
okay.
That is, I've really never heard a satisfying explanation as to why the old Cold War maxim of mutually assured destruction no longer applies to this current situation. It seems to me that although I'll acknowledge that the perpetrators of these kinds of acts are more than willing to commit individual suicide, I don't see any reason to believe that they're interested in committing cultural suicide, which is what would be the result of nuclear retaliation.
But is it, Ivan? I mean, if it went off in New York or L.A. or Chicago, where should Donald Rumsfeld aim the retaliation?
Well, we could start with Saudi Arabia.
I mean, just
start with Pakistan.
If every Pakistani or even some Pakistani is responsible?
The point I'm trying to make is the old Cold War maximum was that the use of that kind of weapon, by definition, would result in nuclear retaliation that essentially takes the whole show with it.
Yeah.
And if it were understood that that is the consequence of the use of those kinds of weapons, regardless of whether it's in the name of, communism mm-hmm. or Muslim fundamentalism, that the end result is that, you know, the annihilation of life on this planet. It seems to me that that would, A, it would eliminate the possibility of any ulterior motives like double dealing on the part of parties such as Iran, North Korea, you name it.
So you're saying let's revive the mutually assured destruction doctrine and spread it, spread the target so wide that if this happened, everybody that might be an enemy would be assured of going down. That's a very big expansion of the case, but let's test it, Ivan. Thanks for your call. Graham Allison, well, what about it?
Well, it's an interesting thought, and I think as we try to think about the Cold War and the Cold War circumstances, the big difference here and the reason why terrorists are, in President Bush's words, the most dangerous actors is that they don't have a return address. So if, God forbid, a nuclear weapon exploded in New York during the Republican convention or at the World Series in L.A. or wherever, okay, the first question would be, who did this? And it wouldn't be clear. There's no easy way to answer that question. In response, if it were done by North Korea or by Pakistan or by any identified state, the U.S. government's plans for retaliating in an overwhelming fashion against that target are unquestionable. And I support that posture completely. But in the case in which the source of the weapon is not identified, or even let's imagine bin Laden announces that he did it. Well, excuse me, we've been looking for bin Laden now for 30-odd months unsuccessfully.
But Ivan is saying, let's up the ante here. We're talking about sort of life and death on grand scale issues. He's saying, well, you got a doomsday scenario. Let's just ratchet up the balance of terror.
But
is that morally, strategically, practically feasible? He's saying, look, if a nuke goes off in the United States, this is what we're going to take out and post the list. I don't know, Riyadh, half of Pakistan, half of the Korean Peninsula. Nuclear stuff gets you into the realm of insanity pretty quickly.
It does, and it's very hard to distinguish between sanity and insanity when talking about something so horrific. But I think that we have to remember, let's imagine, God forbid, that a nuclear terrorist bomb goes off in Washington, D.C., and let's imagine that 500,000 or 750,000 people have been killed.
Yeah.
America will survive. Okay? And you think, oh, my God, can we even think about that? I mean, I spend a lot of my career thinking about cases in which one or two or even a half dozen American cities were destroyed. But America still survived in some way. Now, you could say, well, geez, at that point, let's just all, you know, life is over. Everyone should be destroyed. No, I think that people are going to prefer to live than to die. I would prefer to live than to die under those circumstances. So the question of how we respond against whom and with what consequences going forward will be crucial.
So essentially you're saying the threat of retaliation just doesn't work in this terrorist scenario?
Well, not if we end up retaliating against a party that was innocent and which may even then motivate them to try to do something even more horrific to us. I mean, if we announced that if in the case that a nuclear weapon goes off in the U.S., we're going to retaliate against Russia because it might come from Russia.
Yeah.
Russia might announce that if anything arrives in Russia, an equal number are going to arrive in the U.S., and Russia is the only country that could cause the U.S., the total U.S., to disappear.
And if we're right back in the old game of truly mutually assured destruction.
Right. And with us as the trigger. Because the Russians could be standing there aside. The weapon could have come out of the Pakistani arsenal, and it could have been delivered by bin Laden. So why? I think President Bush has got this point exactly right. When you talk about the most dangerous actors and why the face of nuclear terrorism today is not the face of the states that we were accustomed to thinking about, because I think they could be dealt with in pretty much standard Cold War fashion, as Ivan has suggested. But in the case of people who have no return address. If we can find them, we should kill them for sure, and they should know that, and that we're going to search for them forever. They should know that. But the ability to simply deter them in the standard mad fashion, I think, is not on.
Pat's calling from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, first of all, in response to your previous caller, I think that the only bad thing about that is that these people who are going to get these weapons, they don't value life. Threatening to kill them means nothing, so I don't think that that scenario is going to work. And as far as what you said at the very beginning of the program is why isn't the United States doing enough, you know, what needs to be done, if I didn't know I was listening to an NPR program, I swear to God I was listening to somebody coming out of the White House. This is exactly what President Bush said is going to happen. He said there's a threat. These people have the capability. They're going to put it in the hands of the wrong people. We need to stop them now.
So that's what he said, but do you think that the action has been sufficient, Pat?
Well, you have to start. You got to crawl before you can walk, Tom. And I think that we did something, and now that we
you're talking about Iraq, going to Iraq.
We went to Iraq, and we went into Iraq, and now he's being chastised. But we did something, and I believe that the steps to prevent this is in progress, and you're trying to find a needle in a haystack here.
It's tough. We grant that. Pat, we don't have much time before the break, so let us pick that up. And thank you for your call, Graham Allison. Pat looks at the threat, looks at the Bush administration response and say, well, they're crawling before they can walk. They're doing what they can. They went to Iraq. It wasn't there, but it's a good faith effort. You're far more critical than that. Make your case.
Well, I think that the president got it right, that we have to go after them and we have to do everything physically and technically possible to prevent a nuclear terrorist attack on the U.S. It turns out that, I've quipped for that President Bush showed he's prepared to pull the trigger, and a person needs to be able to pull the trigger, but you need to aim first. In the case of Iraq, we went after a country that did not have weapons of mass destruction and did not pose an imminent threat to us, especially of nuclear terrorism. While two other umbrellas in the axis of evil, North Korea and Iran, have each been up to their own mischief, rushing towards, in the first case, a nuclear arsenal, and in the second case, the nuclear weapons infrastructure.
So this argument we know, but yours is broader. You say that there's all kinds of concrete things that ought to be being done that the administration simply hasn't ordered or financed.
I believe that's correct, and I offer a long list of such items. I think what President Bush should do is put the action should match the words, and the action should be everything technically feasible to be done should be done on the fastest possible timetable to prevent a nuclear terrorist attack on American cities.
How far short of that do you think the U.S. government is falling right now?
Hugely.
Hugely. We're going to have to hear more about that. My guest is Graham Allison. He is director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of the new book, Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. You can join the conversation tonight. Imagine one city vaporizes and bin Laden threatens a second. What al-Qaeda demands would an American president have to meet, be tempted to meet, to refuse? Is Washington deploying its defense resources rationally? Despite all the bluster, is it in denial about the nuclear threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the very real threat of nuclear terror on American soil. My guest is Graham Allison, author of the new book, Nuclear Terrorism. And I should say also, Graham Allison, should point out, you also serve as an advisor to John Kerry. So there is a political element that comes in here at some point. We'll talk about how that may factor in. But I want to invite our callers into this conversation. This book presents a bone-chilling view of how it could happen, says it's fully possible, even inevitable, if not stopped. So you're hearing the extent of the threat. Does it really sound preventable to you? Is the U.S. at grips with the nuclear terror threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Graham Allison, you describe the Bush administration's response to this threat as falling hugely short of what's required. Describe that shortfall, if you would.
Well, I've talked to many of the members of the administration, many of whom I worked with in other incarnations, and I find it still puzzling that given that the president has kind of looked this specter in the face, that it hasn't translated into the actions that you would think would be commensurate with it. And I think part of my purpose in writing the book is to, part two of the book, which is a good news message, says this ultimate catastrophic event is preventable. And there's a big leap in conceptually and in policy terms to get to the proposition that, wait a minute, you can't stop all terrorism, can't stop all catastrophic terrorism. I can't imagine stopping bioterrorist attacks because the biotech revolution running the way it is.
There's fermentation vats all over the place.
But in the case of nuclear terrorism, physics actually is working for us here.
Why? How could it be stopped? How should it be?
Well, the simple syllogism says no fissile material, highly enriched uranium or plutonium, neither of which occur in nature and both of which are hard to make. Mm-hmm. So no fissile material, no fission explosion with the mushroom cloud, and therefore no nuclear terrorism.
So in other words, you've got to stop the fissile material first.
Right. If we can stop terrorists getting their hands on a nuclear weapon or the material from which to make a weapon, we can stop them perpetrating a nuclear terrorist attack. Now, given that there's potentially some material that's already been stolen, that's already in their hands.
And you've got North Korea reportedly working on it. You've got Iran with centrifuges right. going in that can create it.
Right.
Is it already out of the bag?
Well, I think it's not already out of the bag, but I think it's just at the edge of getting out of the bag. I think that human beings know how to lock things down that we don't want people to steal. The U.S. loses no gold from Fort Knox, mm-hmm. not 1 ounce.
Mm-hmm.
Russia loses no treasures from the Kremlin armory, none.
So what's the program that could, that might be mounted to get all of this in a lockbox?
My proposed program has kind of a doctrine of three no's. First no, no loose nukes. All weapons and all material from which weapons could be made everywhere in every country locked down to a gold standard on the fastest possible technically feasible timetable.
What would that cost?
This could cost maybe $3-4 billion a year.
What's being spent on that now?
With respect to what's being spent on that now, less than $1 billion. And it's not mostly a matter of money. This is mostly a matter of a president sitting down with President Putin and the two of them personally committing to each other that they're simply going to do this and that they're each then going to sign up the presidents of each of the other countries, because all of them share a common interest. If a nuclear weapon is stolen in Russia, Chechens are going to go to Moscow first.
But you're saying that right now neither the commitment nor the funding is there.
Neither the commitment nor the funding. And when you look at the actions, again, just to put a sort of a sharp bottom line here,
yep.
In the 2 years after 9/11, fewer potential nuclear weapons of highly enriched uranium and plutonium in Russia were secured to an adequate level than in the 2 years before 9/11.
So there's the proof in the pudding. There's a deteriorating situation.
So first no is no loose nukes.
Yep.
Second no is no new nascent nukes. No
Meaning?
New national production of highly enriched uranium and plutonium.
But we're hearing about that all the time. Pakistan exporting it, North Korea engaging
exactly.
it, Iran now engaged in it.
And Iran is trying to complete right now, rushing to complete its ability to either to both enrich uranium and to reprocess spent fuel to create plutonium. It should not be permitted to accomplish this objective.
By military means, diplomatic, easy to say, hard to do.
I outline in the book what I call a grand bargain for denuclearizing Iran, which is a five-sided deal between the European three, who've been trying to deal with
mm-hmm,
Iran,
mm-hmm.
Russia, the U.S., Iran, and Israel as sort of the club in the closet. You give them all the carrots and all the sticks, but the sticks have to include a credible threat to destroy these facilities by military means if they insist on completing them.
So no new nation development. Your third no?
And the third no is no new nuclear weapon states, and that brings us to North Korea, which is the toughest challenge. But if North Korea becomes a nuclear weapon state, and it may have two weapons now, the CIA thinks it may do, and it's currently, right now, and it has been ever since January of 2003, reprocessing enough fuel rods
right.
for six more additional
mm-hmm.
nuclear weapons. If North Korea becomes a nuclear weapon state with a nuclear weapon production line, which it's also trying
yep.
to do, it will soon be nukes or us, selling nukes to terrorists and to other states. And I've written, and I believe deeply, that historians, if this happens, historians will judge this the greatest failure in American foreign policy ever in our history.
But the Bush administration's scarcely talking with North Korea.
No, the Bush administration's policy on this is totally befuddling if you try to think of it in rational terms. And the explanation, which I know from a number of people inside the administration, is that it has such sharp differences among the contenders within the administration that the only thing that the White House has insisted on is that they not talk about the subject.
A kind of paralysis.
Right.
Let me ask you, you describe in the book and elsewhere Emperor Hirohito's dilemma after Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. He saw one large Japanese city destroyed. He saw a second destroyed. And at that point, whatever he may have thought before, he had to negotiate or even submit to the United States. Can you imagine this kind of scenario emerging in this country? I don't know. Central New York goes, Chicago goes, and suddenly an American president has to make a deal with al-Qaeda? What would that be? What would that look like?
Well, I mean, now we're thinking the unthinkable, but if you gave a good analogy, I mean, after Hiroshima, 3 days later came Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. After Nagasaki, the Japanese emperor simply put up the white flag and unconditionally surrendered, unconditionally. Mm-hmm. In the case of al-Qaeda, most people have a hard time realizing what does al-Qaeda want? And there's been a lot of confusion about this in the public discussion. Al-Qaeda, I believe, has a bizarre and grotesque, but nonetheless quite coherent set of objectives that you can get pretty good view about if you read it. These include, first, Americans' military out of Saudi Arabia. They call that the Holy Land. Secondly, Americans' support, military and economic, for the puppet regimes, as they call them, the corrupt puppet regimes, finished. American support for Israel, finished. So they've got an escalating set of objectives.
We've got about 20 seconds left. Can you imagine an American president put in a position where he has to go on CNN and announce, I am today doing these things required?
I don't think he would acknowledge that he was doing them, but the question of whether he might do them without acknowledging it. If you ask, again, most of your listeners will not know, when did the last American troops leave Saudi Arabia?
Right.
The answer is on the second anniversary of 9/11, without any announcement.
And out they went. It's a chilling, big glimpse of a chilling world, the ultimate preventable catastrophe, as you describe it, Graham Allison. An important view, a view we've got to take on board. Nuclear Terrorism is the book. Graham Allison is the author. Graham, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
You leave me almost speechless. The website is nuclearterrorism.org. In a moment, John Kerry pushes back against President Bush's troop redeployment plan. This is On Point. Two days ago, President Bush announced the biggest troop realignment since the Cold War before the annual convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Cincinnati. Today, his Democratic opponent, John Kerry, used the same venue to blast the president's plan. Bush said he wants to withdraw 70,000 troops from Europe and Asia over the next 10 years. Kerry told the VFW today, quote, "Nobody wants to bring troops home more than those of us who have fought in foreign wars, but it needs to be done at the right time and in the right way." Here is more of John Kerry's address.
The president's vaguely stated plan does not strengthen our hand in the war on terror. It in no way relieves the strain on our overextended military personnel. It doesn't even begin until 2006, and it takes 10 years to achieve. And this hastily announced plan raises more doubts about our intentions and our commitment than it provides real answers. For example, why are we withdrawing unilaterally 12,000 troops from the Korean Peninsula at the very time that we are negotiating with North Korea, a country that really has nuclear weapons? As Senator John McCain said, quote, I'm particularly concerned about moving troops out of South Korea when North Korea has probably never been more dangerous at any time since the end of the Korean War. This is clearly the wrong signal to send at the wrong time.
Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry speaking earlier today at the Veterans of Foreign War Annual Convention in Cincinnati, Ohio. Joining me now is Joe Hallett, chief political writer at the Columbus Dispatch, who was at John Kerry's speech today. Joe Hallett, thanks for joining us tonight.
Happy to be with you.
Give us a sense of the response of the veterans there. We heard earlier in the week something about the response to George Bush. What was the response to John Kerry and his message today?
Well, the response from the audience was cordial, but a bit tepid. It was cooler than the reception Bush received on Monday. The president's speech drew loud cheers and some standing ovations, and while Kerry's remarks were greeted with polite applause. And
how do you read that, Joe?
I'm sorry?
How do you read that? How do you interpret that?
Well, I think that in general, I think the VFW audience obviously is an older crowd. Most of these women and men are 50 or older, and it's also a Republican-leaning crowd. So I think there was some partisanship there. I know that in Ohio, the VFW tends to be strongest in the smaller rural communities. I grew up in a farm town in northwest Ohio, and the VFW post was one of the focal points in town, one of the only respectable places to get a beer. And it was a gathering place. They're just very strong in rural counties in Ohio, which tend to be overwhelmingly Republican. And I suspect that in the South and elsewhere, they are that way. So,
did you talk with vets today? What did you hear from them after Kerry's speech?
Well, I heard a number of sentiments. Some of them doubted that Kerry could deliver on the promises that he had made to veterans, although that part of his speech received the warmest applause when he said he understood veterans' problems and would address what he called shortcomings from the Bush administration.
And this is about health care and after-service support.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of them said they felt betrayed by his anti-war activities in 1971 after he returned from Vietnam. Others, however, said that they clearly valued his service in Vietnam. They thought it was important that somebody with war experience lead the country. One gentleman said he told me he can identify with it. With us, and advisors wouldn't be able to pull a wool over his eyes because, you know, he's been there, he's seen war. And others said that Kerry was right about not pulling the troops out of Germany and other places in Europe and Asia. They were critical that we got into a war without a lot of Allied support, and So the reaction was all over the board, but the audience was friendlier to Bush than it was to Kerry.
And Joe, you're chief political writer there at the Dispatch. We've just got a few seconds left here, but which way is the wind blowing as you look out over Ohio these days, toward Kerry, toward Bush?
Well, I hate to equivocate, but it's 50-50. I mean, we had a poll the other day that showed Bush up by 2 points, which was the margin of error of the poll. And I don't really feel a strong momentum on the part of either candidate.
Tight as it can be, with that, we're out of time. Joe Hallett, chief political writer at the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for joining us tonight. We will do a full hour tomorrow night on veterans and the campaign for the White House. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.